Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. It is 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you as usual live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting and hope that you're listening across the state of Georgia. And once again, we're especially happy that WUGA in Athens has been carrying the show, and we're always glad to have our friends out at the University of Georgia and in the community listening to us. There's an awful lot, as usual, to talk about today. As usual, my political partner on this show, Jim Galloway, the political writer of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here. I never get tired of saying that you can read his column in the Dead Tree edition of the paper on Thursdays and Sundays, and read the Political Insider blog at AJC.com for up-to-the-minute news.
We got to do this fast because I haven't finished the one for tomorrow.
Well, you're stuck until about 2:58, Jim. Sorry. Billy Linville, a Democratic political strategist here in Georgia, joins us at the table today. And we're really glad to welcome back Eric Tanenblatt, who is one of the biggest Republican fundraisers in the Southeast. And we haven't seen you for a while, Eric, so thank you for coming back.
Glad to be here.
And our special guest, really thrilled to have Eric Erickson with us today. You hear Eric on AM 750 from 5 to 7, or maybe you listen to him on 95.5 News. His show is on every weekday. And Eric, you really have become one of the leading voices in the conservative movement. And so it's really thrilled to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I want to start with you, if I can. And I want to pick up, because we just are all absorbing the news out of Istanbul.
Right.
You wrote a blog on Monday, resurgent.com. Mm-hmm.
Yep, theresurgent.com.
Where people, if you want to know what's going on with conservative thinking, you really need to check out his website. You say in the beginning of the blog that it's really about why Donald Trump, to this day, you don't want to see become the nominee. Your first paragraph is, I do not believe that it is impossible for Trump to be elected president of the United States. Events change things. A major terrorist attack, an indictment of Hillary Clinton, et cetera, et cetera. Well, last night in Istanbul, we saw another major attack that Donald Trump jumped on immediately.
Right.
So what do you make of how that affects his candidacy?
Well, interestingly enough, the Quinnipiac poll came out today and has them within a 2 points, Hillary 2 points ahead of Trump, and Trump has seized on this poll as proof that he can beat Hillary. But if you go to the ABC News Washington Post poll, the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, the Quinnipiac poll, the Fox News poll, or the CNN ORC poll, every single one of these polls has Hillary Clinton ahead, but Donald Trump winning on the issue of who better would deal with terrorism. There's such a gap of favorability, unfavorability for Trump. I believe in the Quinnipiac poll today, 60% say Hillary Clinton doesn't share their values, but 68% say Trump doesn't share their values. If there's a major domestic terrorist attack and the Obama administration fumbles it, I do think there's blowback for Hillary Clinton, particularly with the president campaigning with her. But I think it would have to be something like that, although we did see the Orlando attack, and it didn't help Trump in the polling.
Yeah, let's do this, because you've set this up perfectly. I said in the lead-in to the show today that once again, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton responded quite differently to Istanbul. Let's listen to the language that Trump used very quickly after the attack in talking about next steps with terrorists. And by the way, he starts this by talking about waterboarding.
I said, I like it a lot, and I don't think it's tough enough. We have to be so strong. We have to fight so viciously and violently because we're dealing with violent people, vicious people. And, you know, they eat dinner like us. Can you imagine them sitting around the table or wherever they're eating their dinner, talking about the Americans don't do waterboarding and yet we chop off heads? They probably think we're weak, we're stupid, we don't know what we're doing, we have no leadership. You know, you have to fight fire with fire.
Interestingly, Jim, once again, Trump is on TV very quickly and all over the web with a video statement, whereas once again, Hillary Clinton responds with a statement which said in part, the attack in Istanbul only strengthens our resolve to defeat the forces of terrorism and radical jihadism around the world. it reminds us the United States cannot retreat.
And this is where you get into kind of the general election calculations. Is response to a horrific event best met with an outrageous event? Is it best met with more outrage, or is it best met with cold calculation, which is Hillary's response, I think. And I think this gets into she's got a theme that she's cooking here, that Donald Trump is a volatile person who can't be trusted, and that's what she's playing for.
Well, and if you push this further, remember in three debates, Donald Trump endorsed what amounts to war crimes, killing women and children related to the terrorists. You had members of the military, retired members of the military who lean Republican, coming out saying, no way. Now you've got Republican foreign policy experts, Brent Scowcroft and others, saying they're going to support Hillary because of it. If Trump goes too far in this again, he could yet be on the defense again.
Billy, let me get you into it, because you obviously have been a consultant to any number of political campaigns. If you were, it does feel as though Hillary Clinton's playing long ball here. She's playing the long game, as Jim essentially suggested, hoping that over a period of time, voters see that she's calm and measured. But Trump grabs an awful lot of attention when he makes statements like this. Would you be advising the Clinton campaign that she should have been out there in front of the TV cameras on this?
No, I think she handled it the way it should be handled. This is a general election campaign now. This is a general election electorate. And I think ultimately they're going to look for steady, strong leadership. I think that Trump's reaction is another indication that he has not transitioned from the Republican primary to a general election electorate. He is still speaking to that very hard right-wing base that he already has. And I don't think it's appealing to the people that he needs support from.
Eric Tannenblatt, for better or worse, Donald Trump is your candidate. I'm curious how you respond to hearing him use this really harsh language.
Well, he's the Republican presumptive nominee. When you say my candidate,
fair statement. Thank you.
But yeah, I want to see the Republicans succeed in November, and I want to make sure we maintain our majorities in the House and the Senate, and so we need to be unified as a party. However, I will say that Trump is conveying strength. And when you have a situation like we had in Turkey, I think that the electorate wants to see a leader who is conveying strength. He also, I think, is demonstrating a lot more discipline in the past week. Some could say that it has to do with the campaign getting their act together and having one leader and removing Corey Lewandowski from the head of the campaign. I have actually seen a lot more discipline in the Trump campaign. I think a lot of the polls, the more recent polls that have come out, I think there's a lag of about a week or two before you start seeing what the impact of current events is in the polls. So I think next week when we start seeing the polls, it's going to be interesting to see if Trump, the more disciplined Trump, is impacting the numbers and you're seeing the race close some.
Okay, question for both Erics, okay? All right, if we've got a more disciplined Trump campaign, does that mean the waterboarding, the return to waterboarding was vetted and approved by a staff, and that was a group decision that we needed to go there again?
Well, he's on record of where he stands there and disagreeing with people like John McCain and you know, General Petraeus and a number of others. But I think it is talking to those people that are his supporters. I mean, keep in mind, not just the Republican base, there's an angry electorate out there. And it's not just here in America, just like you saw with the Brexit vote. It's all across the world. And Trump is tapping into that.
You know, I would say that there is an interesting contrast between both Hillary and Trump versus John Kerry's statement. John Kerry's statement was that we've got to be right 24/7, 365. They only have to be right for an hour. And you do pick this up in polling, bipartisan sense, that is this the new normal? And people don't want it to be the new normal. And so there is an underlying current there that I think that Hillary Clinton, to a degree, does have to be careful on, in sounding like she also expects this to be the new normal and we just need to expect this and there's nothing we can do about it, versus Trump. That said, I do think that Trump is still bragging. Byron York and the Washington Examiner had a column yesterday pointing out the polls aren't wrong, and yet Trump is still out there saying he's not going to be managed. And they've got him on a teleprompter, and as long as he sticks to the teleprompter, he does okay. But that's not the Trump people voted for in the primary.
Yeah, it's not the Trump that people really are attracted to at all. It's the off-the-cuff kind of wild man Trump that voters seem to like, right?
Yeah, they like wild man Trump. I don't know that general election voters do.
But there was an interesting, in the, I think it was the Quinnipiac poll that you cited earlier, Eric, that came out today. 33% of Latino voters are voting for Donald Trump. Now, try and figure that out. That's more than Mitt Romney got. And I'm just wondering if that's people putting the immigration issue aside, if that is people that are reacting to his strength.
Billy Linville is over there shaking his head so vigorously it may fall off.
Well, I think that Quinnipiac poll is an outlier. I think other more legitimate polls show that up to 90% of the Latinos have a negative opinion of Donald Trump. And I don't see that changing. As we know, the Republican National Committee said in their autopsy report that you need 40% of the Latino vote to be competitive in a presidential race. So I certainly think it's closer to 90%.
Well, you know, on the Quinnipiac poll, I think the big danger for Trump is it looks good superficially that they're within the margin of error. But when you do delve into the demographics, even if he's got 33% of Hispanic voters, he's tapped out with white male voters.
Okay.
I mean, he's reached the ceiling there.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt, but I do want to move on to what I think is the core of a lot of your thinking right now. And I want to go back to the blog you wrote the other day. And let me just quote briefly from one of the paragraphs in here. You say, to believe Donald Trump is going to beat Hillary Clinton requires one to believe so much that is not so and ignore reality. The reality is that this emperor has no clothes. The campaign laid naked and bare is a disaster built on top of a steaming divot. But then here's the paragraph that I really love you to expand upon and get everybody else talking about. Draft Scott Walker. Pair him up with Ted Cruz, unite all factions of the party, then harness the energy of those who detest Hillary Clinton with those who detest Trump and who will be thankful for his replacement. That coalition can win, and you say there's still time to do that and that you can come out of the convention because it's an early convention and have time for this new ticket to build up momentum toward November.
It's the longest of long shots, but I think if the Republicans want to win in November, they're going to have to ditch Trump. I mean, the data is there for them to look at. We're already in June making the arguments as Republicans about the polls that Mitt Romney didn't have to make until after Labor Day in 2012. That should be a big warning sign for them. I don't think Ted Cruz is the guy who can unite the party. I think there are a lot of Republicans in Washington who'd rather sink the ship than have Ted Cruz at the top. But if you notice the biggest Republican donors who are sitting out on the sidelines right now, most of them were Scott Walker donors.
So what are the chances of us having a rebellion in Cleveland, truly? I mean, you've got Reince Priebus very much united with Trump right now. I say very much, but
right.
as
publicly
as united as going to get. You've got a rules committee right now that's stacked against the Trump movement for the most part.
I don't think that it's realistic to think that anything's going to happen.
Why?
I mean, I just think it's going to be too hard to orchestrate something like that, with the caveat that we have 3 weeks until the convention. And if Donald Trump does something ridiculous, which he could potentially do in the next 3 weeks, it could energize that movement. But I just think, just from people I'm talking to across the country, I just don't think that there's enough momentum
there
to do that.
Go ahead, Jim.
Eric, you've been on the inside of this Never Trump movement. I mean, so what's going to happen in Cleveland?
I would say if you had asked me 3 weeks ago, I would have said there's a 10 to 20% chance. I would think today there's about a 40% chance. The reason I say a 40% chance is because of Donald Trump's fundraising numbers.
But what happens? Precisely what happens in that convention? How do they pull this off?
They get enough votes on the rules committee to get a minority vote, a minority report that can be voted on the convention.
That'd be 28
votes. 28 people. You've got, for example, you have Mike Lee, the senator from Utah and his wife are going to be on the Rules Committee. The Colorado delegation on the Rules Committee are all against Trump. The Virginia delegation as well. If they can get those 28 votes and get to the floor, there is an intensive lobbying campaign going on right now.
And what is that minority report about? What will it say?
The minority report says that people should be able to vote their conscience as opposed to being compelled to vote on the first ballot for Trump.
This is the Paul Ryan Amendment.
Yes. Yes, very much so. And behind the scenes, you do have a number of people who are very loudly and publicly supporting Trump. Behind the scenes, working very hard to make sure that that happens.
And plus, but the way that these conventions work, I mean, there's a whole whip operation that's underway with people that are from the Trump campaign and the RNC, and they are reaching out to delegates. And just like you've identified the ones that are absolutely opposed to Trump, they know all the ones that are solidly behind him, those that are going to follow the party leadership, and I just think it's going to be really...
Do they? And the reason I ask do they is because I know three of the whips that the Trump campaign now has are actually absolute Cruz people. And they were approached by the Trump campaign after Cruz dropped out and asked in the last 2 weeks if they would whip for Trump, and they said absolutely, and they detest him.
And you think that they're going to flip in the middle of
That's their plan, is they're working for Trump right now.
Billy, you want to jump in?
Yes, I think Eric touched on an important point. That
Which
is,
Eric?
Eric Erickson
okay.
touched on an important point that is even more alarming to the Republican establishment than the current polling, and that is the fundraising infrastructure for Donald Trump. Currently, he is 40 times less money on hand than Hillary Clinton, and there seems no indication that he can really build a national fundraising apparatus that can raise $400 or $500 million. I think someone like a Scott Walker or a Ted Cruz could have that capability relatively quickly. I don't think Donald Trump can ever build it.
Not that kind of money that quickly. Look, I know what it's like to raise that kind of money. You're talking $400 or $500 million, and I don't think Ted Cruz or Scott Walker can do that. I do think that at a moment's notice, Donald Trump can stroke a check if he chooses to do it.
Right.
One thing he did do, which I think was smart, was there were a lot of donors that were worried that they were going to be writing checks to Trump to pay back his loan that he loaned his campaign for the primary. And he got a lot of pressure and wrote that $50 million check
and gifted it. He wouldn't have been able to raise any more money.
You know, I do have to say, talking to one of the big donors who is willing to write the check, they're still waiting to see the FEC paperwork.
But we do know that Hillary and her allies will spend $1 billion.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
So Jim Galloway, there are two things at play here. There is a Republican Party eager to win the White House in November. There's a Republican Party that I think is probably that Eric Erickson represents, which is what is the long-term future of the Republican Party and the conservative movement within the party? And for the most part right now, they're looking at short term. They're saying that Trump's our man. We're going to ride with him to November.
Yeah, but not entirely, because in addition to the Rules Committee in Cleveland that meets starting the week of July 11th, you've got the Platform Committee. And that, I think, is where you're going to see at least an attempt by Cruz people, by Rubio people, to kind of make sure that they have a party after Donald Trump is done with them.
Erickson, what are your concerns about the future of the Republican Party in terms of all this?
I'm looking at a Republican base, 15 to 20% of which doesn't show up in November. So not only do you lose the Senate, you cut short the House of Representatives potentially. You certainly lose the Supreme Court for a generation. But then you have down ballot races, down to state legislative races that I think are impacted by people not showing up for Donald Trump. I mean, listen, right now the polling shows that 30% of Republicans won't vote for Trump. That number's coming down. But it could still be 10 to 15%, and that matters.
Eric Tanenblatt, you are very careful these days to talk about how you're working for the Republican ticket for down ballot races rather than telling us how enthusiastic you are about Donald Trump. Can you sever the two and hope to retain a majority in the United States Senate, retain other Republican seats that are in some jeopardy at this point?
I think it's going to be difficult without a strong top of the ticket in some of these battleground states where you have some of these competitive Senate races. I think in states like Ohio, where you have, you know, Rob Portman or Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania or Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, even Ron Johnson, although that one, that's going to be a tough race in Wisconsin. And where you have these really close races, I think the turnout on the at the top of the ticket is going to really impact that. And to Eric's point, we could lose the Senate.
Jim, let me give you a last word.
You had a very, and we can get more in this after the break, but we had a very, very interesting statement from Marco Rubio when he decided to get back into that U.S. Senate race.
Yeah, let's. I'm glad you pointed that out. It's a good thing to read before we take our break. He said, we all know by this point that Marco Rubio, always looking for an opportunity to keep himself in front of the American people, is going to run for Senate, despite having said on other occasions he wasn't so enthusiastic about it. He said in that statement, the prospect of a Trump presidency is also worrisome to me. It is no secret I have significant disagreements with Donald Trump. His positions on many key issues are still unknown, and some of his statements, especially about women and minorities, I find not just offensive, but unacceptable. If he's elected, we will need senators willing to encourage him in the right direction and, if necessary, stand up to him. I've been willing to do both. I'm going to do this. Let's pause. We have that statement set up. Let's take a quick break because we're a little late on that. We'll come back and talk about that and a lot more. You're listening to Political Rewind at 2:27 on Wednesday afternoon.
Support from generous listeners like you makes all of the programs that you hear on GPB possible. As our fiscal year comes to a close tomorrow, please show your love for GPB. Make a tax-deductible contribution at the level that's right for you. Please go to gpb.org and click on Donate at the top of the page. That's gpb.org. And from all of us at GPB, thanks for your support.
In an abusive situation, many people call the police. For one Pennsylvania mother, that wasn't an option.
I'd rather them find me on the street than find me at my house like this, because I'm gonna get put out if the cops come here.
Choosing between abuse and eviction later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. With us at the table today, Jim Galloway, Billy Linville, Eric Tanenblatt, and a special guest. Really happy to have Eric Erickson of AM750, of 95.5.
They change their name every other week, 95.5 and AM750.
So you hear him on your drive home from 5 to 7 on both that AM and FM station, my old home, WSB. It's always good to see somebody from my old home here, Eric.
Glad to be
Eric
here.
Tanenblatt. What can we say, Eric? Life is hard for you these days, and I feel bad if you feel we're beating you up about Donald Trump, because we know you were a Jeb Bush man for years, a couple years.
Thank you.
Jim, let's go ahead. Talk a little about two things. The Rubio statement, Trump scares me, essentially. By the way, also about an hour and a half ago, Nate Silver on 538 posted a blog in which he said Hillary Clinton, 79% chance to win the White House. Nate Silver's kind of the wunderkind of political predictions. It's a little early to be going with that.
Right. But I mean, my head is just still spinning. You have a Republican, an incumbent Republican senator standing up and saying, I need to be returned to the Senate because we might put a Republican in the White House.
Right.
That's an incredible statement. And you've already seen others try to start to separate themselves. Mark Kirk up in Illinois, mm-hmm. And I think you're going to see a little bit more of that. Not a little bit.
But the thing with Marco Rubio though is that he has the best shot of Republicans holding on to that Senate seat. And when you're talking about some of these other Senate races, that
I realize that. But I'm just looking at what his argument is for getting back there.
Well, Marco Rubio demonstrates the conundrum that many Republicans are in, because he has said Donald Trump is not fit to be president or commander-in-chief. He's going to criticize him, yet he has endorsed him. And U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham said that when will our love for country outweigh our hate for Hillary? And so they're in a bind, because they've time after time demonstrated that he is unfit for office, but yet they're continuing to endorse him.
All right.
Those general election ads write themselves for Hillary Clinton.
Okay. By the way, we're going to talk about Hillary Clinton and her problems in a minute. But by the way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB if you want to get involved in the conversation. The Twitter started lighting up right before the show began, I think because we tweeted out you were going to be here, Eric Erickson.
That's always a bad thing.
It might be.
Yes.
So you made a point during the break about what we saw happen in the primaries with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket.
There was, during the primaries, a massive wave of anti-establishment sentiment going in to vote for Donald Trump. But what we saw is in those states, Georgia is one of the states that doesn't do this. They have their presidential and general primaries on separate days. But those states that had the presidential preference primary and the general primary on the same day, Trump voters went in, voted for Donald Trump, and you can see it in almost every single state. There are a massive number of people who voted in the presidential race, and then they're not there for the rest of the ballot. And that potentially could happen in a general election where Trump voters go in, they vote for Donald Trump, and then they walk away without voting for the Senate and House.
All right. So let's conclude the Trump conversation by talking about the speech he gave in Pennsylvania. Jim Galloway, you're writing about that right now.
Well, yeah. That's Sunday's. That's Sunday's topic.
Oh, that's right.
I'll get to it. But you had Donald Trump in just south of Pittsburgh get up and basically give an AFL-CIO speech. That said he's gonna straighten out trade. He is going to pull us out of NAFTA if he doesn't like what he's seeing. He's going to really take down China and its positions, and yet you have, I mean, and that might work for Pennsylvania and Ohio, which are swing states that he desperately needs in order to stay competitive. But you've had the whole state of Georgia over the last 10 years, spend hundreds of millions of dollars, expend tons of political capital with his partnership between Nathan Deal and Kasim Reed, all aimed at increasing trade with the rest of the world, increasing trade with China in particular.
Yeah, you've got this nationalistic policies that Trump is espousing that go against everything the Republican Party has stood for, right?
Well,
Eric and Eric?
I remember distinctly when President Obama gave a speech in which he said that ATMs were in part the reason for the decline in bank tellers, and it actually came at a time when bank tellers were on the rise in the country, according to the census. Republicans roundly criticized him for saying that. That's essentially the speech that Donald Trump gave yesterday, and I hate to see good friends of mine, free market economists, contorting themselves to stay in his good graces.
Eric, you're in an interesting position there because you have a lot of friends, Republicans, who are in the business community, who rely on global trade, believe it's important, and now you've got a candidate, whether you're in his corner or not, who's saying, we're going to retreat and live behind our borders.
Yeah, I'm with the largest global law firm. And so, you know, globalization and the global economy is very important. But, you know, let's keep in mind, the last 8 years, nothing's happened to 80% of the Americans in terms of their economic conditions. They're frustrated. They think government has failed them. And so they're looking for change. And Trump is the change candidate. And so, you know, I think, you know, far be it for the establishment, you know, to say, you know, we're for globalization and the global economy.
But Billy, isn't there a different message that Democrats will be able to use? Look, Trump has tapped into that Rust Belt feeling that we've been left behind. We get that. But can't Democrats come after that by talking about when you start building up trade walls again, it's questionable whether the jobs are going to return. But it's for sure prices are going to go up on the very people who are worried about globalization, right?
Exactly. And remember, the United States has the strongest economy in the world. And Donald Trump does say some of these nationalistic things about bringing back the coal mines and other things of that nature. But he is still opposed to an increase in minimum wage. He said that prices or that wages are too high. So he's on both sides of the fence, even on those issues.
So Trump was on prompter for this speech in Pennsylvania. And we do have to say, look, he's playing to the hearts and minds of those voters.
He found his voice, and it was globalism versus America.
And here's just a very brief excerpt of what he said.
I'm going to withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has not yet been ratified. So, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is another disaster done and pushed by special interests who want to rape our country, just a continuing rape of our country. That's what it is, too. It's a harsh word. It's a rape of our country. This is done by wealthy people that want to take advantage of us.
All right. I wanted to keep that alive just to hear Trump say that want to take advantage of us. He's one of those blue-collar guys right. that's out there in the audience.
By the way, in the last 15 minutes, 538 has revised from the 70s. It's now up to 81% since North Carolina polling came out.
Oh, the North Carolina polling. I thought perhaps on this they were some people on this show were being, you know, helping the numbers go up for Hillary.
But the key phrase in that Trump speech was that Trump said we had a leadership class that worshipped globalism over Americanism. I think that was a really interesting indictment, not of just Hillary Clinton and Democrats, but also of Republicans.
Well, it's also clearly a perfect thing to say coming out of Brexit. He's certainly taking his cues from the vote against the EU in Great Britain.
Right, and if this election becomes change versus status quo, that benefits Trump.
Right. All right. Do you want to get one last
just
word in?
One last thing. And this is an overall indictment of a political class on both sides, that free trade helps more people than it hurts. We've benefited much more from NAFTA than we've been hurt by NAFTA. That's why Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush both supported it. But the fact that you have people in Washington who have gotten to the point where they only talk to people in Washington and can no longer relate to the middle class and explain it to workers in the Rust Belt as to how they're benefited, ask the guy who makes the washing machine for Whirlpool whether or not he benefits by having cheap steel prices.
I think that's such a great point, and it's you said better than I did what I was trying to get at with Billy Linville, is the Democrats have an opportunity here to explain this in a way, by the way, that the Conservative Party in Britain under David Cameron
right.
certainly didn't.
Yeah, but Hillary Clinton is not the one to do it. I mean,
no,
you
Bill
can't
Clinton
get,
is.
You can't get. Yeah, but he's not running again, and you can't get any more establishment than Hillary Clinton.
Right. Okay. I want to change subjects because I want to come to Georgia for a minute. Newt Gingrich, yes or no? Will Newt Gingrich be Donald Trump's vice presidential candidate, Eric Erickson?
Oh, I hope so. He's the only one who makes sense. I've been advocating it for months because I'd love to get them on a ticket and watch their egos tear each other apart.
I second that. As a Democrat, I hope that Newt Gingrich is on the ticket.
Eric Tannenblatt, what do you think of the chances of this? Your partner over at Denton's, Randy Evans, puts him at one of three.
Well, I think Newt would add a lot to the ticket. I mean, he obviously has experience working in Washington. But he's also a bit of an outsider. He's been away from it for a while.
Interestingly, you had Tom Price, who represents the 6th District, who was once held by Newt Gingrich. He was asked if he wanted to see Gingrich on that ticket. He said no, he preferred somebody like Tom Cotton.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you do need to look generationally because what's Trump 70 years old? What Hillary Clinton, 69 years old. I'm sure she's going to look at generational issues, too. Elections are about the future. And, you know, the one generation, the millennials, you know, I heard an interesting statistic that when you're between the age of 18 and 26, who you vote for in presidential elections, your first one or two presidential elections, sort of sets your pace for how you're going to vote throughout your life. Because you live in that, you're accustomed to that generation. I voted my first time in the Reagan era, and I'm a Republican. Millennials today, for the most part, have voted during Obama's two terms. So whoever the two nominees are and whoever these millennials vote for, that's going to have a generational impact for years to come.
My first should ditch Trump.
My first ballot was for Newt Gingrich in 1974.
But I think that for president? No, I'm talking about for president.
It was a different Newt Gingrich.
All right, let's move on if we can to Democrats for Iowa, Billy Linville, this week. You know, Hillary Clinton, bad news, good news. A report earlier suggested that her email problems were far worse than has been portrayed before. We won't go into all the details of it, but she was apparently stonewalling, hiding emails that should have been turned over to investigators. It's bad news. On the other hand, we see Trey Gowdy's report, 2 years in the making, on Benghazi. It comes out, and despite all of the attention paid to how it was going to go after Hillary Clinton, the report really added nothing new about her. And in fact, the top five points in the conclusion don't have anything to do with Hillary Clinton.
Yes, it clearly stated that there was no wrongdoing by Hillary Clinton. And I think that once the House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy admitted that its motivation was political, that I think that the American people dismissed it then.
Well, okay, so let me ask you about that. Are you suggesting that the committee, the Republican-led committee, which certainly doesn't want to see Hillary as president, did they put out an accurate report, or were they nervous that if they went after Hillary in stronger terms, it would go back to the to this, you know, what Kevin McCarthy did by saying, look what we've done to her by getting her under investigation? Well, what are you suggesting?
Well, I think that historians will determine how accurate it actually is, but the bottom line, it determined that Hillary Clinton did nothing wrong. This is a committee that lasted longer than Watergate, that lasted longer than 9/11.
But that's not what the report didn't call her out specifically, but it talked about a breakdown throughout the government, including the State Department,
CIA.
Which she led. I mean, that you're giving the typical Clinton whitewash. When there's a problem, let's just whitewash it and move it over. Okay, it's solved. Now let's move on to something else.
I think the legacy of this investigation is going to be the emails. Server. That's the one piece of new
didn't
information.
Help that the Democrats submitted their report and showed that Sid Blumenthal, while advising Clinton, was also getting paid by Media Matters and other outside groups.
It's you know what, Eric Erickson, and then Billy, you need to respond to this. Here's the problem, and you get this. I mean, as unlikable as Donald Trump has proven himself to be to the American people in polling,
right?
Hillary Clinton can't get over 50% because the American people don't like her very much either, right?
You know, it's refreshing in my position this year is not being a water carrier for anyone because I hate them all. and it is really a damning indictment on the Republicans that you have as the Democratic nominee someone that 55% of the public says they do not like, 60% of the public says do not share their values, and yet the Republicans have someone they hate even more.
But I will tell you, the one thing you see Hillary Clinton doing that Donald Trump can't bring himself to do, and that is, I mean, this week she started talking about that fact,
right. Yeah.
that she is bothered by the fact that she's not trusted, and she's going to work to try to solve that.
Yeah, it's been an interesting tone that she's taken on, and it'll be fascinating to see how that plays out. Billy, I said on this show the other day, and now that you're here, Democrat in the room, you've got to, as Democrats, maybe not you specifically, this is the moment at which you say, oh my gosh, what would have happened if we had Joe Biden as the candidate for president? Would there be much, you know, wouldn't he be likely to be way ahead in the polls at this point?
Well, he would probably be more ahead in the polls, but I think that Hillary Clinton will end up being one of the stronger candidates we've seen in a generation.
What is she going to do to turn around? Changing negatives, as you well know, everybody at this table knows, is really one of the toughest things you can do in politics.
Well, this is also part of the times that we live in. It's been, for the last 8 years, have been very negative politics, and I think we're seeing that reflected with Hillary Clinton's numbers. But I think once Bernie Sanders goes away, once the new vice presidential candidate is chosen by Hillary and the convention concludes, I think that Hillary will have an opportunity to really redefine herself once again.
I think it's going to be hard with Donald Trump as the Republican nominee because he's going to reinforce all the things that we've known about the Clintons for 30 years.
Yeah, you've got to. Go ahead.
That's one of the points that I raise in this piece you've been quoting from on why Republicans need to rethink Trump before we get to the convention. Everything that we have on Hillary Clinton is known, and all Trump can do is reinforce those negatives. And I don't know how much more you can reinforce them when everybody already treats them as a negative, and so much about him is unknown. We're about to see a $20 million ad buy by the Democrats in swing states on new Oppo research. Republicans were too lazy to get on Trump. Meanwhile, I mean, yes, people nationwide, they don't like Hillary Clinton. They don't trust her. They know there's an issue with emails. They know there's an issue with Benghazi. And yet all of these things, going back to Whitewater and you name it, they're already out there.
Yeah,
this gets back to what we've mentioned this a couple times in our sessions here, Bill, and that is Alan Abramowitz over at Emory University has a working theory going that this campaign is driven by hatred of the other person, of the other candidate, not by how much you like this one. And you've had two polls just in the last 2 weeks really confirm that. There was a Gallup poll just out this week that says that has more Republicans and more Democrats than ever saying the other party is not only wrong, but it's dangerous.
All right, we're going to have to take another break. Before we do, Eric Erickson, I'm not sure. I want to make sure a lot of the people who listen to this show are hearing you, but just to be sure for those who don't, your antipathy toward Donald Trump is not driving you toward Hillary Clinton.
Oh, God,
your whole point is you don't want Hillary Clinton to be president. You just don't think Trump is the guy to take her down. And I want to make sure we say that.
If you put a gun to my head and told me pick, I'd choose the bullet.
Okay. All right. I want to get that in. Let's take a break. You're listening to Political Rewind at 2:46. We'll come back. We have a number of interesting statewide issues we're going to talk about when we return.
On the next Fresh Air, how the FBI identifies and tracks those on the terrorism watch list, and why the killer in the Orlando nightclub massacre had been taken off the list. We talk with Eric Lischblau of the New York Times. He shared a Pulitzer Prize for breaking the story of the NSA's wiretapping program. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
We're almost at the finish line. GPB's fiscal year ends tomorrow. Your contribution now at gpb.org will help us wrap up this year on strong financial footing so we can continue to serve you with the programs you rely on and enjoy. Show your love for GPB and make a difference now. That's gpb.org and click donate. And thanks so much for your support.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Sitting at the table today, as always, Jim Galloway of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Democratic strategist Billy Linville, Eric Tanblatt, Republican fundraiser and advisor, local candidates, statewide candidates, presidents. He's all over the map. And our special guest, Eric Erickson, who blogs at Resurgent.com, one of the best-known conservatives.
TheResurgent.com.
Thank you.
TheResurgent.com. I invite you to look at it. And who, of course, is on AM 750 from 5 to 7 weekday afternoons. Billy, you said something during the break. We were talking about the negative, the people's negative feelings about politicians. We all agree, I think, usually, that Johnny Isaacson is perhaps the most beloved public official in Georgia. But
yet he's only at a 42% approval rate in the state of Georgia.
Yeah. And he'll, of course, win re-election, right, against...
Well, and that's why you know, he's working as though he's, you know, way behind, even though he has token opposition or someone that's not well-known, but he's raising money, he's out all over the state, and he's working hard.
Okay, let's turn to, we all watched with interest just a week ago, the Democrats in the U.S. House, led by John Lewis, stage a rather unprecedented sit-in because they were pushing Paul Ryan, the speaker, to call for votes on gun safety or gun control measures. You pick the language you want to use, depending on where you stand on that issue. John Lewis just had a town meeting late this morning to talk about next steps. Let's just listen. Trevor Young of our staff got some sound from him. Let's just listen.
Sometime there come a time when you have to just stand up. And sometime by sitting in or sitting down, you're standing up. Some of you know I've been saying for a long time, as I said to my colleagues last week, sometime you have to find a way to get in the way. Sometime you have to find a way to make a way out of no way. Sometime you have to find a way to get in trouble. Good trouble, necessary trouble, and that's what we did. We cannot afford to be quiet. Not any longer.
That's John Lewis this morning at Ebenezer Baptist Church, holding a town meeting essentially on the gun control measures that his Democratic colleagues in here are trying to pass. Eric Erickson, where's all this headed?
Nowhere. You know, we live in a country with 320 million people and 320 million guns. This is one of those issues where I think Democrats, they believe that they're right and they don't recognize they're actually in the minority on this issue. You can issue poll gun control in this country, and depending on how you ask the question, it goes very well. But when it gets into brass tacks on the issue, I think people understand now abortion is a constitutional right, whether or not I like it because the Supreme Court says so. Same with gun ownership.
Jim Galloway, so we're not expecting any action on this, but the question is, whether this has really elevated gun control to being a much bigger issue than it might have been in the presidential race.
Right, right. I mean, look, since James Carville and Bill Clinton kind of decreed it at the urging of Zell Miller back in the 90s, Democrats have just they've shunned the issue of guns in national political campaigns. And I think what this shows, what last week showed, is that you finally at least have Democrats willing to embrace that issue. And Hillary Clinton has done that on the presidential stage, and endorsing a ban on a renewal of the ban on assault weapons.
I think this is a bridge too far for the Republicans. 90% of the American people support no fly, no buy. They support closing the gun show loophole. Ronald Reagan opposed the assault weapons. He opposed open carry. He favored the Brady Bill.
Okay, but they're not going to get a vote in the House. They've already lost their opportunities in the Senate, it appears. So you're suggesting the same thing. You see this as an issue Hillary Clinton will run on and perhaps have some success with.
I think this is another demonstration of what Bernie Sanders tapped into. And we're seeing a new, younger generation of activism, and this is one of the issues.
You know, on the no-fly, no-buy, 90% of Americans do that. When you add to the polling question the list of people, including Ted Kennedy and John Lewis, who got on the no-fly list, and should people be prohibited, the number falls below 50%.
Interesting. All right, let me, I want to move on, but I want to give you an opportunity to hear some of the tweets that are coming in on the Twitter. I say the Twitter because it drives Jenny Ahmed crazy when I call it the Twitter, so I do it intentionally. Khalid says, even if Hillary is indicted, Democrats' number two is Bernie. He's ready to go. And Kevin tweets, and I'm glad you're listening, Kevin. Excellent all caps conversation today. Thank you for listening. Politics GPB if you want to tweet us. Eric Tannenblatt, Supreme Court, big decision this week.
Which one?
Well, very good. Let's talk about their ruling in the Texas abortion clinic case, in which they said that Texas's laws, which required what some people would call punitive, what are the words I'm looking for?
Overly burdensome
requirements for abortion clinics. They had the doctors had to have admitting policies. Boy, I'm having a hard time with words all of a sudden.
doctors had to be they had to be admitted to practice at the local hospital, and they had and the facilities had to be had to be of the same quality as surgical centers.
Okay, so thank you for rescuing me on that, Galloway. So the point is, Eric Tannenblatt, a lot of conservatives were very upset with his ruling. They expected the more conservative composition of the court to rule in their favor. But the big question is, what does this mean here in the Georgia legislature? For any of those legislators who might have been thinking about introducing more restrictive abortion statutes in the next session, does this blunt what they might be able to do?
Well, I think the more short-term impact is going to be the presidential election, because the Supreme Court and who gets put on the Supreme Court is even more important. And that's one area where, you know, Donald Trump showed his cards and presented a list of potential candidates that he would nominate to the Supreme Court, which was widely applauded by a lot of conservatives. And there are a lot of Republicans that may not be enamored with Donald Trump, but they understand that the legacy of the courts is generational, and that's going to motivate them to turn out and vote for him.
Right, and that was a 5-3 decision. Anthony Kennedy, who hadn't been friendly, I think was the guy who really tipped that balance.
Yep.
Yet
shows Anthony Kennedy's institutionally not made to be in the minority.
That's really true.
Yet Donald Trump has remained silent on that Supreme Court ruling, which must right. alarm some social conservatives.
Yeah, and you know, on the list of judges that he would appoint, I mean, if you ask conservatives who distrust Trump, myself included, tell you that every clause of every sentence of every breath uttered by Trump either has an expiration date or is subject to change. So there's still that regular distrust. I would say, though, on the issue of abortion and Breyer's decision, Breyer said in his opinion that if you have existing laws and regulations, adding existing laws and regulations for a criminal isn't going to stop the criminal. So apply that to the gun situation.
Yeah, okay, that's really an interesting.
Okay, but to your question of how this affects the abortion ruling affects Georgia. You've had the state and this doesn't apply just to Georgia, but in state legislatures, you've had two kind of prongs of attacks on abortion. One is the fetal pain bill, and you've seen the legislatures drop the eligibility down to, I think, 20 or 22 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Even the Texas abortion clinics refused right. to contest that.
The other part were these health this concern for women's health and the regulations they were piling on. You had before this decision, people were slowly edging more toward the Texas approach, and that's been closed off now.
Okay, so we're going to watch how that develops here, but it does seem that the Supreme Court has shut down any legislature's efforts to really become to pass more restrictive statutes on abortion. Very quickly, before we run out of time, Jim, you and Political Insider today had a fascinating little item about U.S. Representative Tom Price. What did you all report?
Yeah, well, it appears that in this cycle, he has given away $74,800, maxing out to, I'd say at least two dozen state legislators. And that's something you do if you may be thinking about running for governor in 2018. And we should note that, you know, he's chairman of the House Budget Committee, but that term's got an expiration date. That's in 3 years. And unless there's something in the future, he's out of Senate leadership at that point.
Well,
House leadership, excuse me.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, goodness knows 2016 is going to come to an end quickly and we've got to have other things to talk about mm-hmm. and that gubernatorial race. Are you worried about that, by the way? Or do you always have things to talk about?
Oh, I've always got things to talk about.
All right. We're out of time. Jim Galloway, before we leave, I do want to serve notice. I give you a public service warning. I don't know if you saw this yet, but Ben Carson joked just today that if his mother didn't have Alzheimer's disease, she would likely be shooting dishonest reporters who cover political campaigns. So stay away from Ben Carson's poor mama.
How about reporters who have Alzheimer's?
Well, just another one of the bizarre little developments in the 2016 race. All right, we are out of time today. Eric Erickson, what a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You're
appreciate
welcome. It. You can come back anytime
Thank
you want.
You.
I mean, I know we sort of, you've got to get preparing your 5 o'clock show, though, so I really appreciate
it. Life is research.
Okay. Eric Tannenblatt, so great to have you back. Billy Linville, always an open door for you as well. And, of course, Jim Galloway, thank you for being here. Just a quick note, we're going to take Friday off. Jim Galloway said to me, please give me a longer holiday weekend. And so we're going to do that. And on Friday, we're going to be in our place at 3 o'clock. We're going to be running a Capital Steps 4th of July special, which ought to be a lot of fun. So that's it for us today. Remember, you can continue the conversation at Politics GPB. I'm Bill Nigut. My thanks to Jenny Ament, our wonderful producer, Caroline Hayes, our intern. Thank you both for your help today. See you again a week from today at 2 o'clock.